So which came first for you, a love of comics and art or an embracing of Judaism?
For sure, comics.
Okay.
I'm a comic book geek from the beginning to the end. I remember the first comic I read was when I was about 5 years old. And ever since then, I was just kind of hooked. And then I just started drawing. And then I was that kid that was just drawing in class all the time from middle school all the way through college.
And you are Jewish by heritage. You had a bar mitzvah. You say you were a Hebrew school dropout.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty, I think, conventional story. Mm-hmm. I'm a bicentennial baby. Hebrew school dropout, meaning I had my bar mitzvah, and then that was the end of my Jewish education. Mm-hmm. Come from a very secular family. So Jewish identity was there, but it wasn't an active part of my life. The Jewish interest really came later in life when I was studying abroad in Spain.
Right. You're in school at the University of Michigan studying art. You have an opportunity to do a year abroad. You go to Spain.
Yep.
And then suddenly...
I'm the first Jewish person that anyone's ever met.
All you are is Jewish.
Yes.
Tell me about what this experience was all about.
Well, I was living in Seville in 1996, and I was living with a family and taking classes at the university there. And all my Spanish friends that I met there, you know, they would try and get me to eat the Serrano ham, or, you know, they were asking me what I was doing for Christmas. And literally, people would come up to me in a bar and be like, a friend of a friend told me that you're Jewish. Tell me of your people. You know, and part of me was like waiting for them to kind of look through my hair for the horns or something. But it was the first time that I had ever been called to represent my people. You know, I'm from Philly. I went to University of Michigan. Jews are dime a dozens there. So it wasn't something that made me feel different or special.
So you're thrust into this role as an intercontinental ambassador to all Jews.
Yeah.
And so as a result, you think to yourself, maybe I ought to start learning a little bit more about
my
own religious
heritage.
Exactly.
If I'm going to go around saying that I'm this and I don't have anything to back it up, I shouldn't be going around saying that I'm Jewish then.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to flesh it out. So basically, I graduated from university and was like, okay, I want to make a comic book because that's my childhood dream, is to make a comic. But now I'm interested in Judaism. So what can I do to maybe bring these two things together?
And thus, this project was born, a graphic novel, expanded narrative based on the Book of Esther. Tell me, first of all, a synopsis of this Bible story for those of us who,
sure.
are also not versed
on your old
dropouts
Testament.
of Hebrew school.
It's okay. So the story of Esther is the story of a king living in Persia who is rather...
He's a party animal.
He's a party animal, but he's kind of a buffoon king in the sense that he doesn't really make any decisions on his own. He's kind of always in the thrall of his advisors. And so he's having this huge bacchanal party of 180 days and basically decides to invite his wife, the queen at the time, to come to the party. And she's like, I'm not going to go to that party, which is full of prostitutes and women not of my stature. And so she refuses to come. And then the king's advisors suggest that, you know what, if she's going to reject you, then all of the other women in the kingdom are going to reject their men.
You're setting a horrible precedent here.
You're setting a horrible precedent. And it's basically the story kind of sets up this kind of hierarchical, patriarchal society where if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you're banished. And so then basically the king gets lonely and is like, okay, I need to find a new queen, or rather some people suggest to him to find a new queen. And then he has kind of like a cattle call of all the young virgins, kind of like a penthouse meets American Idol kind of a thing.
And this, we should say, his kingdom is huge.
Massive.
Geographically.
Yeah, we're talking Ethiopia to India.
So this is a large-scale audition.
Yes.
And one that involves sampling the goods, you could say.
Yes, you sample the goods in the evening, the women would come, mm-hmm. and then in the morning they would leave. And this would be after a year-long process of kind of beautification and making themselves ready to appear to the king. And then, boom, they get their shot to kind of shine. And then if the king likes you, you become the queen. And if not, you go to the house of women, where you're basically kept in the harem, and that's your life.
So this audition process goes on and on. This house of women is getting more and more packed with rejects from the king.
Yeah.
And then along comes a young maiden
named
Esther.
Esther. Right. And Esther is described in the Bible with very few words, but she's described as being very young and beautiful, and more importantly, that she finds grace in the eyes of everyone who meets her. So Esther becomes the queen because she has this amazing ability to kind of become who you want her to be on some level. Hmm. And then that's kind of how the story opens, where now there's a new queen and she's a Jew, but she's not telling anyone that she's Jewish.
And we should mention, by the way, that she is raised by an uncle. Maybe an uncle.
Maybe an uncle, maybe not. We don't know. His name's Mordechai.
Yeah. Right, an elder paternal type character.
Yes, who basically hides Esther. And then when she finally gets taken, he's like, look, don't tell people where you come from.
Now, with that as the backdrop, along comes this antagonist character named Haman.
The baddie.
An advisor to the king.
Yes, the big bad is Haman, who basically gets appointed to be the new kind of chief vizier of the king. And he's a rather egotistical guy who has everybody bow down to him and finds out that there's this one guy at the king's gate who's not bowing down to him, and it happens to be this guy, Mordechai. Haman's not too pleased about this and says, you know, why is this guy not bowing to me? And Mordechai reveals, well, I'm not bowing to you because I'm Judean. I'm Jewish. I bow to no man. I bow only to God. But that he doesn't actually say that, but it's implied. Mm-hmm. This does not please Haman. And he's just like, you know what? If this guy is going to reject me, I'm going to go after his whole people. And so he basically comes up with this plot to bribe the king with money to say, hey, look, there's a people in your kingdom, and they don't follow your laws. They follow different laws. And the king's just like, okay, do it. And so he writes this law that says 1 year from now, everyone in the kingdom can murder all of the Judeans in the kingdom and take all of their goods. And then basically writes this law, and it's sent out throughout the entire kingdom. And Mordechai finds out, and he's not too pleased. And so what does he do? He rips off his clothes and covers himself in a sackcloth and covers himself with ashes, and then plops himself down in front of the king's gate and is just kind of making a spectacle of himself.
Mm-hmm. This scene is going on outside the doors of the king, who, we should remind listeners, is married to this niece of Mordechai.
Yes.
So you've got this sort of family triangle here. Certain identities have been revealed. Certain Jewish identities are still secret.
Right.
What happens from there?
Well, one thing that we kind of forgot is that Mordechai's always hanging out at the king's gate. And when he's there, he overhears these two other guys plotting to kill the king. And so right after Esther has been installed as the queen, Mordechai grabs her attention and is just like, hey, you know, you might want to tell the king that these other two guys are trying to get him. And so what Esther does is she goes to the king and says, I found out about this plot to kill you. I didn't discover it. This other guy, Mordechai, did. And so the king's like, well, great. So he has his kind of, you know, cops, PIs investigate the whole thing. The bad guys are found and they're caught. They're killed. And then in his book of days, he writes down that Mordechai saved his life.
A little diary entry there.
Yes.
That gets paged over.
Yeah, it's kind of like a lost episode where they give you kind of something in the beginning of the episode that then at the very end, they kind of wraps it up and kind of allows the plot to proceed.
That detail will become important shortly.
Exactly.
In the meantime, this law has been issued. All of the Jews in the kingdom are in peril. Time is ticking. And what happens next?
So what happens then is Esther discovers that Mordechai is at the king's gate. And he breaks down the law to her and says that we're all going to be killed. And you're not even safe in the king's palace. Don't think that you're above the law. And kind of guilt trips her into basically acting. And Esther really has this moment. She's just like, okay, you tell everyone in the kingdom to start fasting for me for 3 days and praying for me. And then after the third day, I'll go to the king. Because in the time, if you go to the king without him calling you, the penalty is death if he's not too pleased with who's actually coming unbidden. So her just going to the king to talk about something casual as, you know, please don't kill all of my people, puts her own life at risk. Mm-hmm. So she decides to put her own life on the line to try and save everyone else. And this is kind of the beginning of her becoming.
So she steps into the room of the king, unbidden. This has never happened before.
Right.
And the king's reaction?
Hey, what's going on? How you doing? And all of her kind of fear in her head is kind of dissipated. And he basically says, I'll give you up to half the kingdom. What do you want? Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, I'll tell you tomorrow. But first, I want you to come to a party that I'm throwing for you and your advisor, Haman. And then she sets up this party. And the party's full of alcohol and food. And it's kind of the beginning of her kind of setting the stage to manipulate the king and Haman.
So she creates this theater venue, in a way, for the king and his advisor Haman to have an interaction.
Right.
What happens?
So basically, she has this party, and everyone's excited. They're getting their drink on. The king says, well, I'll give you up to half the kingdom. What do you want? And she says, well, you know what? Come back tomorrow for a second party. again, you and Haman, and I'll tell you exactly what I want. So she's totally building anticipation, and she's really working it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next part of the story is this nightmare that the king has, where all of a sudden, and this is literally the turning point of the story, where the king's dreams wander. And then he wakes up in the middle of the night, and just kind of like young children wanting to be read to fall back asleep, he kind of bids his servants to come and read to him from the Book of Days so he can fall back asleep.
From his old diary.
Right. And so he conveniently enough opens up to the page where it's noted that Mordecai saved his life. And so he says, well, what happened to this guy, Mordecai? Have we honored him? And he finds out, well, no, nothing's happened. And then just at that moment, there's a knock at the door and it's Haman.
Mm-hmm.
And Haman is kind of puffed up because he just had an encounter with his wife where his wife was like, you know what? You need to get rid of this Mordecai cat and kill him. And so you should go to the king and have the king build a gallows to kill Mordecai. So Haman's kind of coming in with this kind of new awesome idea and knocks on the king's door. And the king just had this horrible nightmare and says to Haman, well, what should I do to honor someone who has done good to the king? And Haman thinks that that the king is talking about him. And so he's all, yeah, I'm going to.
But of course, he's talking about Haman's mortal enemy.
Exactly.
Mordecai.
Mordecai. And so basically what happens is Haman then is completely humiliated and has to lead Mordecai through the city of Shushan on the king's horse in the king's clothes, basically shouting, this is what the king does to honor someone who he deems worthy. Completely humiliated. And then, to make things worse, he's late for the second party of the queen.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes to the second party, and, you know, the alcohol is out again, and she's calm, cool, and collected. And basically, the king's like, all right, well, what's the deal? What do you want from me? And Esther's like, look, someone's out to get me, and they're trying to kill not only all of my people, but they're trying to kill me. And the king's like, well, who would do such a thing? And she basically, at the table in front of, you know, the king and Haman, points to him and says, you know, this guy. And the Hebrew is really amazing here because it's very lyrical. And it goes, Haman hara hazeh. And it's very da-da-da-da-da-da. And she's basically like outing him as, here's the big bad right here in front of you. And we don't know what's going on in the king's mind because he's now just discovered not only is his wife Judean and Jewish, but his head man is trying to kill his lady. And so he's just kind of like, what's going on? So he gets up and he leaves. And then Haman starts pleading for his life. And Haman actually falls to his knees and kind of grabs her. And
which is a big no-no.
Big no-no. No one touches the queen but the king.
Uh-huh.
The king returns, sees what's going on, and is just like, wow, in my own house, this guy is going to be so bold?
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the servants says, hey, you know, this guy Haman built these gallows for this guy Mordecai. Why don't you put him on it instead? And so basically the big bad basically has to suffer the consequences of the plot that he had kind of set in motion.
Meanwhile, JT, there is still this law in place,
right,
where after a year, it's still decreed,
yep,
that all of the Judeans in the kingdom are going to be legally killed and
all their goods
divested
plundered.
Of all of their possessions.
Yeah.
So can she convince the king to take this law off the books?
No, because back in those days, there were no such thing as amendments or propositions. You actually had the law was immutable. No king could even retract his own law. So you just had to write a new law. And so what Esther does is she convinces the king to not only appoint Mordecai to be the new advisor, but she and Mordecai together write a new law that says the Jews can defend themselves.
And so this conflict does not go as originally planned.
Correct.
By Haman.
Right. Whereas originally Haman's idea was to kill all of the Jews, now the Jews now end up killing all the people who were trying to kill them. And basically the end of the story of Esther is quite gruesome. 75,000 people are killed in one day, but none of their goods are plundered. And this is kind of the ability for the Jews to defend themselves and then at the same time consolidate the power of the new queen and the new visor. And that's basically how the story ends, except for one little piece.
Do tell.
Well, basically, the story of Esther is associated with a holiday, and that holiday is called Purim. And basically, Purim is a holiday where we commemorate this role reversal and providence that Esther had and the ability to kind of take everything and flip it on its head, where even when you're at your most bleak and dire moment, there's still hope for the most amazing things to actually happen.
And on a concrete level, basically what it means is you, as a Jew, are commanded to get blindingly drunk for a day.
Yes. It's kind of like it's the pressure release cooker of the Jewish calendar cycle.
Well, interestingly, there is no mention of God in this book. It's
yes.
A secular book.
Yeah, it's also, it should be noted, the only book not to be found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran Scrolls, which is considered the oldest version of the Bible. So it's probably the last book to be canonized in the Bible.
So what do you make of that mystery? I mean, what do you think the real providence of this Book of Esther is all about?
I see the story of Esther as the first kind of internal propaganda that the Jewish people told themselves, that if one of us is in danger, we're all in danger. Basically, you have this story where one person can make a difference. It's also kind of very American that if you work hard, you can kind of, you know, raise your station in life. In this sense, it's working hard with your mind, not maybe on your back. But Esther was working with her brain to try and figure out, how do you take such a negative scenario in a system that's, you know, built on oppressing women, built on oppressing Jews, because, you know, this is when Jews are kind of kicked out of where they're from, don't really have any power. And then how do you work that system from the inside out to get what you want?
And it's a story that ultimately has got all of these plot arcs and literary devices that make it just ideal for comic book
treatment, or graphic novel treatment.
I should say. We haven't even begun to talk about the visual element of this production. This was not something you whipped up in a month. You spent years and years of your life working on the images that go along with this expanded narrative. Tell me a bit about the visuals that make up the other half of this whole production.
I did 4 years of research before I started drawing anything. And I did the research on the art history of Persia and when the story took place. And I also was researching how the story of Esther related to other biblical narrative pieces. It was really important for me to connect Esther to a larger scene. As a story, it's got so much detail. It describes, you know, the type of stones that are in the court of the king. Detail that isn't common in the Bible. And so for me, it was such an amazing blueprint to draw. The text itself was kind of goading me into, how opulent can you make this? How extravagant can your interpretations be? And also remember that Jewish culture has always been, shall we say, hesitant in its relationship with graphic images. I mean, the second commandment is, don't make any graven images. So another reason why I chose the story of Esther as a comic book is because God's name isn't mentioned, I'm not really doing anything that is sacrilegious, or sacrilegious, sorry, Simpsons reference there.
Sacrilegious.
So as you can tell from my references, I'm extremely versed in pop culture. And so it was also important for me to take a story that had been sanitized and kind of lost to my generation of American Jews, and kind of redo it in a way that I could understand and absorb.
There are images that are racy. There are images that are graphically violent. You don't pull your punches. It's an unblinking treatment of this story.
Oh, it's a PG-13 story for sure.
Yeah.
I think alcohol is mentioned, I think, 40 times in all of the Bible, and I think 22 of those times are in the story of Esther. And so it's a story of sex, violence, and political intrigue. So that's something that any generation is going to connect with.
Well, J.T. Waldman, congratulations on a beautiful graphic novel, and thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
J.T. Waldman speaking with The Signal's Aaron Hankin. Waldman is the creator of the graphic novel Megillat Esther, and you can find a link to more about him and his work online at jtwaldman.com.